This is All Football Commentators Are Geeks with Michelle Owen, Alex Crook and Sam Matterface.
Hello and welcome to the latest instalment of All Football Commentators Are Geeks with me, Sam Matterface from TalkSport and ITV.
And Alex Crook from TalkSport and National Newspaper Journalist.
Joining us this week, a massive name from across the pond as NBC Sports' Rebecca Lowe joins us to talk growing up with Peter Crouch, wanting to be part of the next French and Saunders, and how she almost gave it all up because of rude football managers.
Also this week, we find out why it wasn't just Ole Gunnar Solskjaer for whom the wheels came off at Goodison Park.
True story, and we'll discuss Sky's terrific and compelling coverage of the Manchester Derby and why Crook is glad that Leeds have messed up on automatic promotion.
And why did Rafa Benitez refuse to shake Sam's hand? That's all on the podcast that's worked out. You could have flown from London to Las Vegas since Brighton last scored a goal. All football commentators are geeks.
Shots on a Friday.
Back of the net!
Yeah, this lot think I'm talking about the championship match. This is All Football Commentators Are Geeks.
Okay, first of all, an apology if you've been waiting for the pod. We're a little bit late this week because of the busy Easter schedule, and we wanted to wait until sort of the midweek matches were out of the way because we wanted to give you the best possible picture of how the end of season run-in is shaping up.
That's right. I think we both had four games in 4 days. I was at Bournemouth on Saturday, did the Cardiff-Liverpool match on Sunday, Brentford against Leeds on Monday in the world's smallest press box. I've got a funny story about that later. And then we both covered Spurs last night, which was a very difficult commentary just because of the lack of attacking intent that Brighton showed. My co-commentator, Kev Watson, said it was the best defensive performance he had ever seen. But not too many of my Twitter followers agreed, including Jamie O'Hara, who was raging about how negative Brighton were.
11 hours without a goal. I mean, it's all fine and well if it works in your favour and you grind your way to safety. But if you don't, then the gamble backfires, doesn't it? I mean, because what you're actually essentially saying is that Cardiff aren't going to get any more points or not going to get enough points to trouble you, which may well be the case. But if it isn't, you're in serious trouble. I think the problem with Chris Hughton's strategy is you can't turn it on and off like a tap. So, for example, let's just say Cardiff beat Fulham on Saturday. All of a sudden, they know they need to win that game against Newcastle at 5:30, which I'll be at on Saturday night. How do you turn a team that hasn't scored a goal since in the Premier League since the 9th of March? Yes, the 9th of March. How do you tell them to start being expansive again? I think that's really, really difficult to do. But we are recording this moments after the Manchester Derby, so I need to check in with you on that because United are on their worst run since 1962. How are you feeling? Are you feeling okay? Are you as raging as Roy Keane in the eye roll or... are you Graham Souness, tub-thumping and completely furious about the lack of intent from the players getting close? I think they were more annoyed about the defenders getting close to both Bernardo Silva and Leroy Sané.
Do not really annoyed me tonight. Gary Neville, after the game, praising the United players for their endeavour, effectively for trying in a Manchester derby. They've been given credit because they worked hard. It's not good enough. But this is the worst Manchester United team I have ever seen. There was only ever going to be one winner tonight. And what really annoyed me again, Paul Pogba strolling around, not trying for the first goal. Watch a replay of the first goal. He is jogging back. He's the closest United player to Bernardo Silva. He gets nowhere near blocking that shot. David De Gea beat him from distance again. Ashley Young, every time he gets the ball in a wide area, hits the first defender. Not a single United player came out of any credit. The only way Ole Gunnar Solskjaer is going to salvage this is by getting rid of the prima donnas, get rid of them all, play the kids next season. We might finish 15th. United fans will back him for that. But what we can't keep doing is playing these players who are on 400, 350 grand a week and they are not trying a leg. Roy Keane hit the nail on the head tonight when he said the United players threw Jose Mourinho under the bus. They will throw Ole Gunnar Solskjaer under the bus.
If they end up finishing 15th next season, which they're not going to do because they're not going to do what you suggested, even if they did finish mid-table, it wouldn't matter too much to the Glazers because commercially, and that is unfortunately the priority for the football club. And the issue being here is that it's like when you have a boss who sets a certain culture, you respond to that culture. The Glazers have set Manchester United up to be a financial institution, a cash cow, to draw money out of the club. And because they've got that intent, because they set that agenda, that they look upon it as an opportunity to make money, everybody else in the organisation looks upon it as an opportunity to make money. And that's the first priority of everybody that's in it, rather than what it should be, which is winning trophies and being a football club. And because that isn't the priority, there's no way that they're going to do what you said, which was strip it bare and start again. Now, I think there will be a huge churn of players in the summer, and I think Ole Gunnar Solskjaer's got to be given license to do that, because the manager is not the biggest problem. Even if you don't think that he is the right man to take them forward, it almost doesn't matter anymore. What matters is that you get back to the sporting culture being the most important thing, and that isn't the most important thing at Manchester United at the moment, and I think that's of real, real concern. I watched them on Sunday, and I use the word abysmal. Now, I think when you're describing a football performance, it's very rare that you will use the word abysmal. But on Sunday, they Rancid. Were absolutely terrible. I've never seen anything like it. It's also the same word that I would use to describe the Mitsubishi that I hired this weekend that conked out in the car park at Goodison Park. I spent 3 hours after the game doing laps of the car park, waiting for the AA man to arrive. But his sat-nav was working about as well as Paul Pogba's sat-nav that he uses to laser guide his pass towards the corner flags, and went to the wrong place. So I was there for even longer than I should have been. But, you know, look, at the end of the day, with Manchester United, you just have to think that it's not going to get better anytime soon, and it may actually get worse before it does get better. So
It wasn't a great weekend for TalkSport employees by and large in their cars, because David Connolly, the former Ireland striker, managed to lock his keys in the car at Norwich on Good Friday. He had to call Norfolk Fire Brigade to come and break in to get him on his way. He cycled to Brentford on Monday. I think that was a very good idea.
I don't think that's a particularly good thing to do, is it? He called the Norfolk Fire Brigade. Why didn't he just smash the window? I don't think emergency services. It reminds me of the kid in America who called 911 because he'd run out of McDonald's and he didn't want to wake his mum up. It's not the best use of the emergency services, I wouldn't have thought. Now, you would have noticed by now that Michelle is not with us again. She's not very well. It's got nothing to do with her being an Aston Villa fan and it being bad for your health. She does hope to be back with us next week, though.
Language of love. Our favourite words in the football lexicon.
So last week I asked you where bicycle kick came from, and I said to you that Deadly Doug Ellis claimed to have invented it, but it didn't come from Deadly Doug. I don't think he was around in the early part of the 1890s when it is claimed. And there's loads of different claims about the origin of this, but a lot of it seems to originate from the South American continent, and where a lot of Europeans, especially Scottish and English men, went in the late 1800s to try and sort of get on the economic boom, exports coming from down there, up here, coffee, other bits and pieces. And a lot of football was exported by us, by, you know, Britain and European powers down into South America. In Chile, there was a guy who, and there's, I think one of the great things about South American football is the way that they took on what was a sport that was popular in Northern Europe and then just made it their own. And one of the ways they did that was by coming up with inventive ways of scoring goals, being more expressive on the ball, keeping hold of the ball for longer. And one of the amazing moves and big developments was the bicycle kick. And I think the common consensus is it originated in Chile.
The Geek Sheet. This week in numbers.
Pep Guardiola is the first manager to win 3 consecutive away Premier League matches at Old Trafford.
Wolverhampton Wanderers were 3-0 up at half-time in their game with Arsenal in midweek, the very first time that they've led a Premier League game by 3 goals at half-time.
Brighton have racked up 11 hours without scoring since they last found the net Theresa May has secured two Brexit extensions.
N'Golo Kanté scored his fourth Premier League goal of the season on Monday night for Chelsea, one more than he's managed in these three previous seasons in England combined.
Southampton now hold two records in the Premier League for the fastest goal scored by Shane Long after 7.6 seconds and the fastest hat-trick by Sadio Mane. In the time it took Mane to score the fastest hat-trick, Shane Long could have netted 22 times.
The Geek Sheet, this week in numbers.
So, you've heard the stats behind the weekend's big stories, but what did we learn in the tunnel after we'd left the press box, gone down into the sanctity of the players' tunnel? Two great stories for you from Newcastle. Rafa would not shake my hand this week. So, Rafa Benitez at Newcastle went to I didn't actually do the interview. What I did was just helped him up to the press box where he joined Laura Woods and Stuart Pearce for an interview. And actually, I think it was one of the best interviews we've done so far this season. It was long. He stood up there for about 10, 15 minutes and he talked about his plans for Newcastle United and why Newcastle's board should invest in the kind of wages and transfer fees that he wanted so that he could ring fence Newcastle's position in the league and give them an opportunity to compete for honours. And he was very calm. He's very astute. He was talking, actually, and I thought this was really fascinating, about how modern management works. And when he was at Real Madrid as the B coach and he used to watch 7-8 games of a weekend, he had to do it all himself, make all of his notes, do all the scoutings, the fast forwarding, the pausing, the rewinding. But now he's got a team of people to do that for him and he trusts those people. And he's almost like a delegator, an arch delegator. This person will watch that game, somebody else will watch another, he'll watch three or four himself, but they'll all feed in on a Monday morning and then come up with a plan as a result of that. And I think that's a real insight into the way that modern managers, big managers, work, and that is by using a lot of delegation, not micromanaging every single little thing, which some do, some don't. I think they're usually heads of big organisations now. So I shepherded him up to the press box where he was going to do his interview. And as I left him there, I just said, right, see you later. Good luck. Have a good one. I'm going down to speak to Ralf Hasenhüttl. And he went, okay. And went to shake his hand. He went, no. I haven't been well. And gave me a fist pump. He's like, you know, when you punch it in. He's like, oh, all right, chill out. And then Laura and I, because Laura works me every Saturday, but then she works for Sky on a Sunday. So I was doing some stuff at Goodison Park. We were both going to the same game. And I said to her, look, I'm going to stay over at Newcastle because it's very difficult to sort of get from, I'd be doing something else on the Friday. Then I had to get the train up to Newcastle. Then I needed to drive over to Everton. Then I needed to drive back. I said, look, I'm hiring a car on Saturday. I'll drive you over to Goodison if you want me to on Sunday morning. Laura's got this thing where she wants to be in the next venue on the night before, whereas me, I want to enjoy myself after I've done a game and I'll get up early in the morning and go to the next match if that's the case. So I've decided to get the car and Laura says she's going to hire a car herself or she's going to get herself across to Goodison Park. Anyway, the next day I see her and I said, how did you get across then? She went, oh, funny story. I was like, oh yeah, go on. She said, well, I was talking to Rafa, obviously, you know, and he lives on Merseyside. I went, he didn't give you a lift. She went, yeah, sort of. Rafa's agent said, do you fancy coming with us? And I said, oh, yeah. And he said, well, we're going in a helicopter. I was like, what? So there she was, me in my little Mitsubishi Shogun, scuttling across the M62 and Snakes Pass and all that, and then getting stuck in Everton for 3 hours because it conked out. And she got a 30-minute ride in a helicopter on Rafa's chopper. Not bad, was it?
Incredible. How the other half live, eh? Most of my post-matches were quite uneventful in comparison to that. As I've already mentioned, I was at Brentford on Monday to see Leeds mess up promotion once again. I didn't feel particularly sorry, though, mainly because of the attitude of some of their non-playing staff. I've had this before when it comes to Leeds, in that they still conduct themselves with an arrogance that they think they're still a massive club, which clearly they aren't. In fact, they have now spent longer out of the Premier League than they did in it. As commentators, we always like to try and have an idea of the team lineups and any changes before the official team sheet comes out so we can prepare properly and also be ready to break the team news once it is released around about an hour before kickoff. Usually, most press officers are pretty helpful in this department. They'll give you a heads up as long as you promise not to release it early, not to break the embargo, which of course we wouldn't. Not the Leeds guy, though. He just point blank refused to turn with the team until after it had come out via their official Twitter page or website. I thought that was pretty petty. And after the game, another club employee tried to stop me and a colleague from Five Live going down to the area behind the dressing rooms where the interviews were taking place because Marcelo Bielsa was, quote, doing his live with Sky. We're hardly going to walk straight in front of an interview, are we? What's that all about?
How did you find the Griffin Park press box?
Oh, my
Because it's really tight, isn't it? Really tight.
Really and tight.
Once you're in, you can't really get out because there's only one entrance, isn't there? It's at one end, if I remember rightly.
I think one of our producers, Jez, hit the nail on the head when he said it was like being on a Ryanair flight. I fully expected to have to put in a claim for DVT at the end of the match, I've got to be honest. Clearly, nobody in Brentford is over 5 foot one or weighs more than 9 stone. It was so ridiculous that at one stage, I thought I was physically stuck, literally. I was facing the wrong way, trying to squeeze in, so the pitch was behind me at this point. I couldn't turn my body physically because my legs were so squashed next to each other. Producer Deck, who we've mentioned on previous podcasts, was in absolute hysterics. I think he wanted to film it. I didn't see the funny side.
I wonder whether or not it's actually more to do with your size than anything else, because there's not many people as big as you. You are rather large, aren't you? I mean, and I'm not being nasty. You just are quite big.
I'm long-legged, and there's a lot of long-legged journalists who I'd imagine would have the same problem.
You are listening to All Football Commentators of Geeks, the podcast. Next up, I'll be speaking with ESPN's Rebecca Lowe.
Some people are on the pitch. They think it's all over.
The only people you know that can legitimately buy a pair of binoculars. This is All Football Commentators Are Geeks.
Hi, Rebecca. How are you and where are you?
Hello, my friend. I am very well, and I am in the car on the way from home to San Francisco Airport, where I'll catch my pre-regular Friday flight to New York City and go to work to do the Premier League for 2 days.
Okay, I bet you're looking forward to it, because it's going to be a belting weekend, I'm sure of it. I don't know really where to start, because you've worked at the Beeb, Satanta, ESPN, the UK, and in the States, and now NBC is the main anchor of the Premier League football. Is it difficult to walk around your neighbourhood now in the States without being recognised? Because you're West Coast, so you're kind of a big deal.
No, I mean, I have noticed a difference in just terms of, like, people knowing who you are a bit more as the years have gone by. I've been here 6 years now, Sam. So when I first got here in the first season, it was only a fanfare if you were a football fan. So it became massive to football fans already established, because suddenly there was a channel that showed every single game, and it was just loads of shoulder programming, and it was like a big, big change for them. But in terms of kind of, no, not being recognised. But now it is different. I'm on the West Coast, and I don't look anything like I do on telly when I'm walking around my neighbourhood. Let me just tell you that.
Let's go back to the beginning then, if that's okay, and start with how it all started for you. Did you really go to school with Peter Crouch?
Don't you love how stories take on legs as they go on? No, I didn't go to school with him. He and I grew up in the same neighborhood in Ealing in West London, and we got lots of mutual friends or people that we both know, and we grew up in the exact same area, so we're very similar upbringing in that way geographically. But he would go to he went to Drayton, I think it was called, and right. I went to a girls' school, and we walked to school every morning at the same time. But he was with his best pals, these twins called Robert and Edward, and his other friend called Ollie, and they would walk on one side of the street, and me and my girls would walk on the other side of the street, and we'd always like meet at the sweet shop on the way back from school, but like none of us would ever talk to each other. And it was really kind of typical 13-year-old behavior. He always had a tennis racket slung over his shoulder because he was brilliant at tennis. If he wasn't going to be a footballer, he could have tried to be a pro tennis player. He is a brilliant tennis player. But it was one of those things where, like, we sent Valentine's Day cards to each other's groups, but never, like, spoke to each other. And then I interviewed him years later, and I was like, and I walked in, he was at Southampton, and I was like, hi. And he was like, oh, God, I'm having a flashback. I was like, no, let's talk about the sweet shop. And we just had a hilarious, like, reminiscence. But so now, well, I mean, I haven't seen him forever now, but we were kind of pals while we were both working in the same industry. Well, not pals, but you know what I mean? We would reminisce every time I saw him. But no, didn't walk to school with him. Never in a million years thought he'd end up being Peter Crouch. We were more interested in the twins, I'll be honest with you, Sam.
Did you actually talk to him, though, back then? Or did you just talk to his knee? Was he always really tall?
So tall. I mean, he had this tennis racket on his shoulder, and that was, I just have this image in my mind of him with his three mates, and he was at least a foot taller than them, even then, walking to school. So we just saw him as the big lanky chap that, you know, we liked his mates.
Did you always want to work in football?
No. I always wanted to be an actress. That was the main aim from the age of probably 9 or 10 until I graduated from university. That's what I wanted to be. That's what I trained to be. That's what I wanted to do. Football was just a love I had that my dad instilled in me from the age of 9 when he first took me to a Palace game, and that was it. But I never crossed my mind to go into journalism ever. In fact, everyone in my family's in journalism. My brother's in journalism. He's at Times. My dad, my stepdad, my stepsister, everyone except for me. And I was never interested. But then life sometimes changes for you and you don't expect it and you certainly don't plan for it, and everything changed when I applied for this competition when I left university.
Yeah, so are you living proof that these talent competitions actually work then? Because
because
you beat 650 people, I think, to get recognised as a BBC television football reporter after winning a competition.
Yeah, I mean, what happened was I left uni, and my friend and I, she was a year below me, and we thought we were going to be the next French and Saunders. So, but obviously I was a year older than her, you know, as you do. So I thought, well, don't worry, Lucy. I said, I'll work for a year and I'll get us some money, and then we'll get an agent. And then when you graduate, that'll be it. Like, obviously we'll be famous and really successful. But the problem was that when I left university a few months before, she had actually given me a leaflet from the Virgin Megastore. Do you remember them?
Oh, yeah, I used to work in one.
How funny is that? Right, so the Virgin Megastore was running this with, I don't know why, but it had a link to the BBC, and it was a BBC talent search for this, search for that. And one of them was a search for a new cast for a sitcom. So Lucy and I, thinking obviously we're so talented, we're like, well, we'll definitely apply for that and probably get it. And then I looked through the leaflet and she said, why don't you apply for the football reporter? And I was like, well, no, because I've never reported. I love it, but I've never reported. And no, she's like, oh, you should just do it because you love football. And like no other girl in those days did. So I always stood out. I said, oh, all right, fine. And when I do something, I really do it. I don't just half do it. So I had to do like 8-page application with photos of why I love football. And one of my photos, would you believe, Sam, you'll remember this guy, was me standing outside the players' entrance at Selhurst Park with David Tuttle. Remember him?
Yeah.
You're like, yeah, just... So that apparently that proves my love of football. How hilarious.
I think that does prove your love of football, doesn't it, really?
I know, doesn't it? I bet you've got no other pictures of David Tuttle with anybody in the world. So I had to do that, big application, sent it off. We also auditioned for the sitcom, and it was hideous. It was in a disused church in Brixton, and we turned up 6 a.m. on a Sunday morning in amongst like a lot of drunk people and just had to go in a circle, and these BBC execs were like, okay, guys, go round and everyone's got to be funny. And it was just, I can't even tell you any more than that. It was so hideous. Didn't get it, obviously. Graduated.
You did get the right one, by the sounds of it.
Yeah, I think so. I think, yeah, graduated. And then I forgot all about this competition. Had sent off the application form. And then was working at Talk Sport, answering phones, because I knew somebody who worked there. And suddenly got this letter in the post saying, you're in the next round. I'm like, of what? Oh, my goodness, the football one? Oh, geez. And then there was like two more rounds. And then the final was at Football Focus. Ray Stubbs was presenting. And there's 7 of us there. There were 5 girls and 2 guys. And I was like, I think I might have a chance here. The BBC's looking for a woman, clearly. And it was 2002. So they were just starting to get, you know, into the let's get politically correct on the women front. And I won it. And the rest is kind of history, Sam.
And that wasn't the last time that you bumped into Ray Stubbs, was it? Because you ended up working with him at ESPN for a while. He was actually on our podcast just a week ago. Did you learn a lot from him? Did you learn a lot working with him?
I learned so much. I think, first of all, you could just won't ever meet a nicer man. I just love him to pieces, Ray. When I joined him again, I mean, when I won the competition, he was so nice that day. And then I was a reporter on Football Focus when he was presenting it. And he just always had time for you. No matter who you were, always had time for you. So approachable. Him and Mark Lawrenson were like a little double act together. I always remember they took us all out for drinks at Christmas and paid for everybody. And I just looked up to him and just thought he was an absolute megastar. I really did. And he is the nicest man ever. And then at ESPN, it was like being reunited, and we became really, really close at ESPN. And I watched him a lot. I learned from how he did things. He's just so humble and normal and down to earth. I adore him. He's great.
Yeah, he's great. We work with him now on Talk Sport and Talk Sport 2. And yeah. He's very much the same as Ray. Ray ended up having a bit of a problem illness-wise, but that wasn't the only reason, I'm sure. But you presented the FA Cup final in 2012. You were the first female to do so. What were you thinking at the time? Did you realise it at the time? Did you just think it was about time? What were you thinking?
No, I knew. And I mean, it was the only reason, to be fair, Sam. I mean, Ray had a heart problem, which was detected, and then they had to operate and take some time off. And that really was the only reason I did it, because he was the main man. I was always the number two. But yeah, when I got the call, I went from the executive ESPN, I was a little bit in shock and terrified, but also 100% not turning, obviously not saying no, so got to do it. And then I got a call from the press officer at ESPN to say that Des Lynam was going to do a column in the Telegraph about it. And that really was like the biggest thing that probably ever happened to me in my life. I was like, what? They're like, oh yeah, we've given him your number. He'll call you today at 11. When my phone rang, and it was like, this is Des. Honestly, Sam, I could have finished my career then and been happy for the rest of my life. Des Lynam, oh, it was just amazing. So yeah, I knew, and he made a thing about it being a woman, obviously, and I knew that. But all through my career, it was just, there was so much of that, being the first woman to do this, first woman to do that. Not only just me, but other women. And it was just, I don't know, I just wanted to get to that point where that wasn't a thing anymore, you know, that wasn't the first woman anymore. And now at least that's happened and gone. But it was hard. It was difficult to do it that day. It was a long, we did 8 hours pitch side. But I mean, I think it was the moment in my brain that made me realize I probably could do this for a few more years, because I was having thoughts of leaving the whole profession because I didn't really enjoy the pitch side stuff. But that day I thought, you know what, maybe I'll just keep going a bit longer. Maybe I can do this.
Well, that's amazing. Obviously, you'd done so much stuff before then. You'd worked on Satanta, you'd presented programs for ESPN, you've done discussion programs, you've done loads of stuff. And you were thinking of giving it all up because you just didn't like doing what, the pitch side interviews, the post-match stuff?
Yeah, I didn't like doing it at all. And that's where I used to see you all the time. And that's where you and I would chat when you were there for TalkSport and I was there for ESPN. And I just found it thankless. And I also found it very difficult. There were a lot of managers, I'm not going to name any names, but there were managers who made my life really, really difficult. Some would demand to see the questions before, but then they go on to the next person, they wouldn't demand to see the questions. And yes, the next person was a man. So, what do you read from that? I don't know. And I would say, no, you can't see the questions. And then you'd end up having this like standoff, or a manager would come in, and one manager came in once after a game and said, you be careful what you ask me today. And it was that day, and that's one of many moments, but it was that day. And the players were all amazing. The players never had a problem with the players. It was always the managers that I had a problem with, which was funny because at the time I was engaged to a manager, which was amusing, but I suppose a lot of them didn't know that. But it was one day that it was the game, and the manager came in, the first manager for the game came in and said, don't ask me about this player. And it was a player that was, you know, on speculation about leaving. And I said, I have to ask you. He said, well, if you ask me, I'm going to walk out. I said, well, it's your right to walk out, but I have to ask you the question because otherwise I'm not doing my job. Or that whole normal conversation you have. But he was so nasty. I asked the question, he was horrible, and he just stormed off. And then post-match, the other manager that day came in, and that was the time he said to me, he stood at the door, he swore about me. He said, she better not effing ask me about whatever it was. Came in, said to me, you be careful. As he stood there next to me in front of the camera, he said, you be careful what you ask me. And I went home that night and I said to my fiance, and I called my dad. I always used to call my dad as soon as I got in the car. And I said, you know what? I don't want to do this anymore. And I was never going to be the number one anywhere. I felt like I was never going to be the number one. So I wanted to be a studio presenter, but if I wasn't going to be the number one, I didn't really want to do it. And I didn't want to do pitch side anymore. And my contract was running out. Had like 9 months left on it before ESPN lost the rights anyway. And I was like, you know what? Maybe I'll open a coffee shop. I genuinely thought maybe I'm done. Maybe I've had a really good ride. Maybe I was never supposed to do this. So I really contemplated it, but then I got a call from my agent. Things changed.
I was going to say, but now you are. number one. And you're not just number one in terms of being on a network, but you're the number one football presenter in one of the biggest countries in the entire world in front of a huge audience in an emerging market. And everybody knows you're not only there, but over here as well. Everybody's seen what you've done and is very proud of it, I think, on your behalf, really. I mean, you must be incredibly proud that you've managed to do that, because it is all your dreams coming true, isn't it?
Yeah, thanks, Sam, for saying that. I appreciate that. It's funny because you sort of feel like you're forgotten when you move to America, but that's nice to hear that, because I can't sort of feel that, really. Yes, I mean, you say that. When you say, you know, you're the number, I'm like, I still pinch myself and say, well, that's ridiculous. How on earth did that happen? I am so grateful and so lucky that certain things happened. I chose to do certain things, which then got seen. But it's not, you know, a lot of it's luck. A lot of it's getting that opportunity. And yes, there's a lot of hard work, of course. I mean, I don't think I've stopped working just constantly working forever at myself and getting better and trying to improve and trying to be seen. I am really, of course, I'm really, really proud. I think it's a bit like, this sounds, Sir Alex Ferguson used to say, like, he used to try and get him to say, you know, come on, how amazing is it you've won all this? And he used to be like, no, I can't think about that now. I have to do the next thing. And I sometimes feel like that, like I should try to enjoy this more. I need to try and enjoy it more, because that's what you should do, live in the present. But I'm always trying to think about the next thing and next season and what else do I want to do and try to achieve more all the time and set my little boy an example to reach even higher than you already are. So I sort of, Paul, my husband's always saying to me, God, you're always looking for the next thing, just enjoy it right now. And he's right, I should, and I should try harder to do that. But when I do take a moment, yes, I'm kind of speechless.
Is it the Palace fan in you that you're always worried that it's about to come to an end very quickly?
Yeah, 100%. Probably is. The fact that we're still in the Premier League after 6 years, I still pinch myself at that. I mean, what on earth is that about? That's not Palace. So, yeah, it probably is.
I suppose you must be pleased, being a Palace fan, that they're going to stay in the league. But you're also pleased, I take it, that you don't have to go to Selhurst Park every week, because at the time of recording this interview, it is officially the most boring ground in the country. You know that. It's seen less goals than every other one of the 92 grounds this season.
My goodness, I know. The weirdest thing about Palace is this myth that Selhurst Park's a really difficult place to go. And it's just not. We're just rubbish. You know, all the managers are like, well, you know, we're going to go to Palace. I mean, everyone knows what it's like to go to Palace. What? You can just score like 5 goals if you want. It's fine. Yeah, we're really loud. We have amazing fans. And I think it's the most beautiful structure in the history of the Football League. But it's not really particularly intimidating, is it? And we are a little bit tepid. But we're in the Premier League. We're mid-table mediocrity. And I will take that every day of the week, Sam.
Fascinating to hear from Rebecca, and I really do think that she has sort of set a new standard for the way that soccer is broadcast in America. I don't know if you've seen much of it, but it is brilliant the way they do it. And it's something that we'll never see over here, because what they do is they show you all the goals at halftime from the other Premier League games on Saturday at 3 o'clock, or if they're doing a midweek game, and it stings between everything so very quickly. It's almost like she's doing a soccer special and a live football presentation all at the same time. And she's the only presenter of that show. So if there's a 12:45 kickoff or a 12:30 kickoff on a Saturday, then she will present that, then the 3 o'clock, then the 5:30, and if there's a 7:45, she presents that as well. So you know, she's on for a very, very long time, and she does a brilliant job. I thought what was really interesting was that she might not have never been doing that job if she had decided to jack it in after 2 or 3 seasons with ESPN, where she was just getting fed up with managers not treating her correctly. And the idea that a manager would walk into a TV room after a game and demand to know what questions he was going to be asked beforehand. I'd sort of get it if you're a foreign manager in your first season, you don't really speak English and you want an idea of what's going to be said because you sort of want to get a handle on your answers and it's not your first language. But if you're an English manager or you've been around for a while and you can speak the language perfectly, I don't understand why you feel it's okay to ask for that sort of level of information.
No, it's terrible. And I think the good thing over the last 2 or 3 years is that female reporters and female correspondents have been much more receptive, and that just wouldn't happen now. It did happen to me once, actually, with Roy Hodgson. Crystal Palace got hammered at Bristol City in a League Cup game. And one of the Crystal Palace players tossed his shirt into the crowd at the end of the game. They threw it back at him. Clearly, I asked Hodgson about this afterwards. He didn't react very well. And the Crystal Palace press officer said to me, oh, you should have given me a heads up that you were going to ask him about that. And I thought, no, I shouldn't.
It's weird, isn't it? I mean, you know, the idea of telling someone what you're going to ask them just before you're about to do it. I think one of the other things is that I don't always plan the questions that I'm going to ask. It happens in natural conversation. I was doing an interview the other night and I actually knew I had one question left and I thought, shall I ask a question about this or shall I ask a question about that? And I had to make a split second decision. And actually, afterwards, it was about Maurizio Pochettino in the tunnel, live on TalkSport, straight after the game against Brighton. And he was really happy. He was in a great mood because they'd just scored in the last couple of minutes against a team that had basically done nothing apart from defend for the whole game. And I think he was relieved. He came in. They did the radio live before they did any of the TV. So we were pretty happy about that. And I'd asked him three questions. I could tell that the director of communications, a very good guy, Simon Felstein, was trying to wind me up and, you know, just finish off the interview now because they had to go and do the other bits, which is fair enough. And he'd sort of mentioned, because I'd asked him about Christian Eriksen and how important he was to the team and how you need players like that to come up with special moments. And he'd sort of touched on the fact that they want him to stay and that he is an integral part of the team and we're hoping that he will stay with us. And there was part of me that wanted to go back in on that and really focus on the sort of the minutiae of the detail on Christian Eriksen. And are they going to offer him a new contract? How are talks going? But you know that he's already said as much as he's going to say about it. He's not going to give you any more details about it. And you're asking just for asking's sake. So instead, I went on a different line and asked him about the decision that he made to bully, not bully, but to push Daniel Levy into getting the stadium ready to come in before the end of the season because he believed it would be a massive boost. Now, in retrospect, did I make the right decision or not? Well, we still got the answer about Christian Eriksen because he brought it up himself. But I did think to myself, maybe I should have finished with that one instead. But, you know, it swings and roundabouts. I don't think he was going to say, oh, yeah, well, we've spoken to him. And, well, I know subsequently, because he was asked in the press conference about it, he didn't give any more details than what he'd already offered up to me. But, you know, you do come away from it thinking, gosh, did I go for the right one there?
Yeah, that's always the worst feeling in the world, particularly as a radio commentator or reporter when you get home and you watch Match of the Day, the Match of the Day reporter will ask a question. You think, I should have asked that. I've missed the best line. Luckily, I usually know how to get the best lines out of a manager. But yeah, you do go home and critique your post-match interviews and compare them to other people's.
Okay, well, we've got loads upcoming this weekend. I'll be down at Brighton for Saturday's game against Newcastle. It's a must-win for them. They haven't scored since the 9th of March. And they've had 47 shots on goal between then and now and haven't scored a single goal yet. So it's a massive turnaround that they've got to do on Saturday night because I think they'll probably need to win that game no matter what happens. I'm at Brighton this weekend. Where are you?
I'm at Southampton Bournemouth on Saturday. This is quite cracker. Funny, actually. No, Bournemouth fans have been singing all season, you know, we're the number one team on the South Coast. Southampton, if they win this game, go above Bournemouth in the table, which is incredible when you think how Bournemouth started the season and where Southampton were at the turn of the year. You mentioned you were at Brighton. We haven't touched on this too much. We've hinted at it and the problems that Chris Hughton may well be facing. But I've got to say, that was difficult to watch the other night. I do agree with Jamie O'Hara. They never tried to win the game. They did it against Wolves as well. It's only going to take them so far. I've always been a believer. I know you possibly disagree. They are going to stay up this season because I don't think Cardiff are going to get enough points. But for me, Chris Hughton will be right up there with the favourites to be the first manager sacked next season. There are problems in the dressing room, from what I understand. Players have gone to him and pleaded with him to play a more attacking brand of football. He's declined. I think he might have taken Brighton as far as he can.
Well, I mentioned to you on this podcast, I think it was, 4 weeks ago when we first heard rumblings about it. And I said that's one to look at in the summer. I am absolutely gobsmacked that he has continued with the strategy. As I said before, I don't think you can turn it on and off like a tap. It's a massive gamble. It may not end in relegation, but it could. And I wouldn't take that. 100 million pound gamble if it was me.
I'm doing Burnley Man City on Sunday, by the way. Is the title race now over? Are we at 11:53 on the 24th of April declaring Manchester City as champion?
No, there's still at least three games to go. And we wait till the end because these two deserve the respect of waiting to the end because they're the two best teams that have played the game in this country since I've been watching it. They've been so consistent and ruthless throughout the course of the season. They've been fabulous.
But the title race is over. Manchester City will win every game between now and the end of the season.
Okay, so you've made another binary choice, a 50-50 call, and you've called the team that have a narrow advantage with three games left. How bold you are. That was the All Football Commentators of Geeks podcast. Big thanks to Rebecca Lowe for coming on and for you at home at listening. Next week, we've got the angriest, but one of the most eloquent men in radio. Mark Saggers is going to be our special guest geek. And we'll have Clive Tilsley on the programme between now and the end of the season.
It's all over, I think. No.
Subscribe via iTunes, Spotify, Google Podcasts and all major podcast platforms. This is All Football Commentators Are Geeks.